ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's hard to get your loved ones to change their habits, let alone change world history. But that's exactly what happened with apartheid.
And a demonstrator has run right through the play.
Australians and millions of others took a stand and helped to bring the racist South African regime to its knees. I'm Sisonke Msimang, and join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Geraldine Doogue.
And I'm Hamish McDonald.
This episode of Your Call, we're doing things a little differently.
That's right. One of the topics you send us the most questions about is China. And we've had the pleasure of heading off to the State Library of New South Wales to speak with one of the world's preeminent historians of modern China.
Yes, between our questions and those of the audience, I think you'll gain precious insights from Frank Dakota's deep well of knowledge about how the China we now know came to be.
That's coming up on Global Roaming Your Call.
Yes, Hamish, each week in our mailbag, somebody asks us to follow up some question about China, and we just didn't think we could do better to answer this than to tap the views and wisdom of a visitor to Australia for a special Sydney Writers Festival event, namely Professor Frank Dakota. Now, he's a Dutchman. He now divides his time, though, between Hong Kong and the United States, and his book Red Dawn Over China sketches really in some quite extraordinary ways how Mao Zedong and his companions won authority in China after 1949, after a brutal civil war, setting up really the basis for Xi Jinping's Chinese Communist Party.
And what I think listeners will find really interesting is the way he thinks that shapes the China of today and the way it projects its power on the global stage. And I think he adds a layer of depth, knowledge, insight, and frankly, like dense detail about what happened. You're going to hear really the best bits, the standout bits, starting with how he plunged into local and provincial CCP archives, like literally 300 of these massive documents, barely used, barely accessed, making his way in to discover what life was really like before 1949 and afterwards.
I think what you'll really hear too was how much influence has come to be ascribed to Confucianism as one of the shaping forces of modern China. That was really an interesting part, wasn't it, Hamish? Because
yeah.
Xi Jinping has suddenly started to talk about Confucianism again, whereas Mao had spurned it.
Here he is now, Professor Frank Dakota.
Now, Frank, welcome.
Thank you.
This is classically, I mean, I'm distilling very much a sort of a tale about how the winners write the history. But what we're really intrigued by is how that influences the way modern governments deal with China, which is something that, as you can imagine, preoccupies Australia and Australians. So make your case, please, that a lack of knowledge about the rise of the Communist Party does influence, deleteriously, I think you say, the way modern governments deal with China.
Well, you don't have to read this book. I mean, you can read any book on China, but it's when you have a state that has been around for so long and has such an extraordinary reach that its story, its foundation myth is found everywhere, not just on Wikipedia and on all sorts of media, but also in, you know, very learned volumes written by quite esteemed academics, then it gets quite frankly rather tricky.
I'm kind of curious about this notion that research often seeks to challenge existing knowledge, to solve a research puzzle. What was the puzzle in existing research that prompted this book?
That's a very good question, because I'm at heart an evidence-based historian. You know, there's this term evidence-based medicine. I always thought, what kind of medicine is not based on evidence? What kind of history is not based on evidence? But of course, a lot of history is just theory, theory, theory. You know, I read a few books and I summarize them. So to find the evidence is crucial. 2020. And COVID happens, Hong Kong is closed down, I can't cross the border into the mainland, what am I going to research? And then I started looking at pre-1949, And I found that there were some 300 volumes that had been published internally. So you can't buy them, you can't find them in libraries. They're published in the 1980s for the eyes of the leadership alone. 300 volumes that really assemble every scrap of paper written by any branch of the Communist Party from 1921 to 49. It's all assembled by the central archives in Beijing. Then when I found that, that really was... That,
how did you
to
find,
me,
how
was
did you
the
find,
foundation.
I mean, that's
well, they're all smuggled into Hong Kong, you see. You know, Hong Kong used to be the Berlin of the East.
So how did you discover that this is Central Party Archives? I mean, that's an amazing story.
I mean, what is so amazing is that they actually set out to do this. But, of course, in the 1980s, they didn't really think that these volumes might end up somewhere else. So that was my great luck. And that solved, if you wish, the research question is interesting. How do you get from 21 to 49? But to me, the more interesting one is, you know, where do you find the material to actually study that?
Now, it is interesting, some of the things that are happening under Xi Jinping. He announced back in 2012, just to bring it right through, to he's the successor of all this, at the start of his reign, that he wanted to create this socialism with Chinese characteristics, the China dream. Why do you think he felt the need? Because, you know, because he did look, they do look pretty settled, certainly by comparison with what you're describing. Why did he feel the need to introduce such an emphasis to modern Chinese people?
The one person who tells other communist parties to reflect their own local conditions is Stalin in 1943. He himself tells other communist parties, you know, in Europe, in Asia, you must not just imitate us. You must have your own particular culture. You must adapt to social conditions. And why does he do that? Well, he can see the end of the Second World War, Stalingrad. He can see that the tide is turning. And he realizes that on the march towards Berlin, he will occupy a certain number of countries. So the communist parties in those countries must look genuine. They can't look like they're somehow, you know, things imposed by Moscow. So it's the same thing here with good old Chairman Mao. In 1943, he starts talking about the sinification of communism, the sinification of socialism. He said, you know, we are different from the Soviets. Yeah. We rely on the peasants, not on the proletariat. We have our own conditions and culture and this and that. So I would say all along, from Mao Zedong to Xi Jinping, there's always an emphasis on Chinese characteristics.
Right. Okay.
But ultimately, it's just a one-party state.
Xi Jinping, though, in recent years has started talking about Confucianism in a way that surprised some people. How do you place that in what you're describing?
Benito Mussolini was great when it came to the Roman emperors and Adolf Hitler wanted the Third Reich. But it's just all nonsense.
You think it's just bunkum?
Yes, absolutely. You need to read the Constitution. So what does the Constitution say? There are four cardinal principles, and they've been repeated time and again by every leader. Uphold the socialist way. Uphold Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought, yeah. Uphold the Communist Party of China, and uphold the people's democratic dictatorship. I can hear Orwell. Where is Orwell?
Okay, but I mean, if in part what we're talking about tonight is narrative and a nation's own expression of itself through history and you know the story it tells itself of itself.
Yes.
If the current leadership decides to lean on those Confucian ideas and tries to interpret that or weave that into the narrative of China today...
Yeah, but you're getting sidetracked. This is not... It's not about Confucianism. The story is a country humiliated for 100 years by Western powers, which is then immiserated, oppressed by imperialist powers, feudal with the fascist dictatorship under Chiang Kai-shek, and thank either the Lord or Karl Marx, for the communists to appear from 1921 onwards and liberate hundreds of millions of villagers who propel the Communist Party to power so that they can liberate the country in 1949. That's the official story.
Sure.
That's the story.
But Why is it then bunkum to weave some of this other stuff in if they choose to do that?
Oh, you can, of course. I mean, why would you not have Confucius?
But Mao didn't like Mao thought Confucius, yeah. I think I'm right, he thought it'd ground them down, that the tradition, this very hierarchical tradition, had actually robbed
It was
China.
Also about the individual, right?
Yes and no. I mean, there's something called the May 4th Cultural Movement from 1919, when Confucius becomes, in this country, a widespread symbol for old-fashioned feudal hierarchy. You know, women should obey man, children should obey their parents, etc., etc. So there's a widespread movement of criticism against Confucius and tradition more generally. This is not the communist at all. This is, you know, liberal scholars like Hu Shi.
Right.
This is across the spectrum.
So why rehabilitate him now?
So why now? I mean, you could say during the Cultural Revolution, all of this is completely destroyed. Taoism, Confucianism, anything to do with the past. Why now? Because they haven't got very much. You need to come up with something. I mean, what is socialism? It's an economic system. It's not a culture. You need to fill it up with something.
So what are their strengths then, cultural strengths? What I'm trying to get at is, they clearly have developed some things that out of this combination of violence, of yes. adaptation, of rediscovery of some of cultural strengths, or you know, a centrality of Confucianism. Is all this coming together in a cogent way?
There's nothing to do with Confucianism. This is socialism. What is socialism? Socialism is means of production belong to the state. What are the means of production? It's one of these Marxist sentences, which is just hard. So when the good old chairman dies in 1976, we think of the 1980s and 90s as this sort of period of reform and opening up. But what Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, and Xi Jinping today want is much greater control over that economy so that they can build up some great machine that really works. So to this very day, if you just look at the land, you know, who owns the land? Is there a single villager who owns a plot of land? No, the land belongs to the state. That 99.5% of assets of banks belong to the state. Energy is controlled by the state. Most big enterprises are controlled indirectly or not by the state. They can move vast numbers of people around. 30% of the labor force in China, we're talking, you know, something like hundreds of millions, I think 300 million is the latest figure I saw, are migrant workers with no access or unequal access to very simple resources like education for the children, welfare, health, you name it. They can be sent back to the villages at the beck and call of the state. These are issues to do with human rights, nothing to do with Confucianism.
Sure.
When you have no unions, you can do what you want with your workforce.
You're listening to Global Roaming, and this is an interview with scholar Frank Dakota that we conducted in front of a live audience about China's modern history and how it influences the nation's view of itself these days. We took several questions from the audience during the event, which I think you'll find most interesting.
Maybe I'll go to the most popular one first. So Jersey asks, in what ways has China changed since the imperial era? And in what ways has it remained the same? I wonder which imperial era you're talking about, Jersey, but that's
okay.
The question.
The imperial is a very good point. The empire collapses in 1911.
Yeah.
No. So, and one of the most remarkable things, unlike all the communist propaganda about that period, is how very rapidly China became a republic. I mean, there were more people voting in 1912 in China, immediately after the collapse of the empire, than anywhere else in Asia. But overall, this is an age, the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, which is just so open to the rest of the world, with ideas, people circulating, tens of thousands of students sent abroad, a country keen to embrace the world and modernize in the best sense of the world. So that is something we forget. And why do I say this? Because frequently we jump from empire into Communist Party. So empire, old-fashioned, one-party state, also old-fashioned. You know, you think of a red emperor. Mao's a red emperor. Xi Jinping is a red emperor. It is not an empire. Emperors did not have tanks. They did not have cameras. They did not have digital identification of their populations. They couldn't set up concentration camps, etc., etc., etc. So in that sense, China is an intrinsically modern country. And it's precisely because of all these modern technologies that it is so important to have a counterbalance, which I refer to as separation of powers. I mean, a great many philosophers have talked about this at great length, so I won't repeat it, but separation of powers does help.
But it did, you're quite right, and we do sort of talk, there was an explosion of occurrences in that period from 1911 until 49, and yes. We barely know because it was so complicated and yes. messy, and there was so much happening in our cultures as well, yes. so we averted our gaze, I yes. suppose, is the argument, isn't it?
Yes. So what you point at is very, very important, that when we look at China after the collapse of the empire, the Qing Empire, when we talk about the 1910s, 20s, 30s, it is extraordinarily complex. The capitals that move, there are warlords, there are alliances, coalitions, and nationalists, and the communists over here. But that's the objective reality. It's a difficult period, but extraordinarily, you know, open and exciting, and a period that should be rehabilitated right. because it's really been discredited. But
and what do they think about that? Do they talk about that at all?
Rarely. But the point I want to make is that precisely because of such a complicated period, Red Star Over China, which is, you know, this book echoes, a book written by Edgar Snow, a book that presents this period as a simple tale of this oppression of the majority until the communists arrived to liberate them, the sort of tale
of propaganda.
That's why it's so appealing, because it simplifies the whole story.
George has a question for you, Frank. Is it true, George asks, that the Chinese remember the humiliation by the Western powers of the Opium Wars, and the Chinese are motivated by a long-term desire for revenge?
I'm not sure that your average farmer who can't afford to buy spectacles for his son in the countryside is really all that preoccupied by what happened over, you know, a century and a half ago. But it's true that the propaganda about the Opium War, the so-called century of humiliation, is just relentless, absolutely relentless.
Well, it was humiliating, though, for it, wasn't it? Really
was it more humiliating than the scramble for Africa?
The British, you know, just sail up and just said, gunboats, you know, and two just said, we're coming up and we're taking over.
Was it more humiliating than the scramble for Africa? Was it more humiliating than what happened in Congo under Leopold II? Was it more humiliating than what happened in India, a country completely overtaken by the Brits? Every country was humiliated. What do you think happened to France when the Germans invaded in 1870?
But I think there's something in that question. There's actually a few questions along these lines about a motivation around revenge.
Yes.
Do you think that exists?
Yeah, absolutely. But that's widespread, isn't it? You could go very far with that. That there's all one-party states cultivate not just this image of great strength and power, but also this narrative of victimhood, of humiliation, of something that must be redressed at all costs. Remember the good old chap Adolf Hitler, 1933. That's all about revenge against the Versailles Treaty and how the Germans had been humiliated.
It's a powerful emotion.
Very powerful. The question is how many people believe it.
Okay, so Glenn M. has a question and he wants some more on the book specifically, but he says, why did no Western nations in all the years since Russian Revolution until 49 aid the nationalists to defeat the CCP, especially in Sun Yat-sen's lifetime?
I think that's not entirely true. I think a lot of Western countries were very keen to collaborate with the central government, the ones we refer to as nationalists.
I suppose it is interesting to remember that there was that great debate after the communists won, who lost China in
yes.
America?
Yes.
Stimson was the Secretary of State, posed that question, I think, and there was a huge
yes.
degree of, frankly, there was real searching out
yes.
what had gone wrong,
yes.
who had gone wrong. So there was a great sense that
yes.
America made some huge errors.
Oh, I see. Yes, yes.
I think that's probably what they're quite getting at.
So first of all, throughout the 1930s, there's a great amount of interaction between Nanjing, the Republic of China, and Europe, Japan, other countries, all very well established. The key point really is that indeed from the Americans from 43 onwards are very keen on having a coalition between the central government and the communists, and impose this coalition from 46 onwards.
Hemingway went there, didn't he? Hemingway went there to try to cover it.
This is true. So there's a lot of journalists who do visit Chongqing, which is seen as the capital of, as it was termed at the time, of free China.
Yes.
And they, of course, are free to do and visit and write anything as they please. They can, but they cannot go and visit Yan'an, capital of the communists. They can't go there. So when American and foreign journalists are finally allowed to go to Yan'an and visit the communist capital in 43 and 44, it's all been nicely cleaned up. They are taken on guided visits to model, you know, model schools, model hospitals, model farms.
So you think that's where it started, the sort of propaganda started to tilt, do you?
That's where the Americans start saying, ah, these people are not really communists. They are really agrarian reformers.
Oh, yes.
Reformers. Stalin lends a hand. Stalin says in 43, you remember 43, he abolishes the Comintern. He goes further. He tells the Americans, you know, those communists in China, they're not real communists. They're margarine communists. So the Americans make this mistake time and again, thinking that the Chinese communists are not real communists. They make this mistake in 45. Make it again, Kissinger, Nixon, with the rapprochement, 71, 72. Kissinger says, you mentioned Confucian. So this is a Confucian culture. Confucian, it's nothing to do with communism. It has. Bush Senior, after the Tiananmen massacre, where I thought, again, 200 tanks, 100,000 soldiers to crush the local population is a pretty strong signal. But nonetheless, Bush Sr. is the one who says, you know, they're not real communists. We should really help them get back on their feet. And Clinton, WTO. If we help them economically, if they join the WTO, now with economic reform, they will become responsible stakeholders and evolve into a democracy. And here we are.
Chamberlain has a question, Frank. During the Cultural Revolution, there was a wide array of propagandistic plays, music and text.
Yes.
What do you say of contemporary Chinese pop culture?
You know, I spent 20 years in Hong Kong, and I'm a great fan of Canto Pop.
What about dancing bots?
But it is very remarkable that a small city like Hong Kong, 7 million people, has produced so much more in terms of popular culture than all of mainland China. So very interesting. And not just, of course, Canto Pop, but also, you know, in cinema and novels and you name it. A powerhouse, Hong Kong.
Because?
Because, of course, there is a system called One Country, Two Systems. And Hong Kong thrived when the mainland didn't interfere.
I wonder if you have some wisdom to impart to the audience here, all of whom I suspect are here because they want to understand China.
Yes.
How do we, you know, I think we're often encouraged to kind of step away from our own values and ideas and perceptions of the world in trying to understand China. So we understand what you've said about your approach to telling the history. But for folk here that are trying to think about China today, take its history into account, but also look at what it is, what it's doing, how it might shape the world that we live in, what would you say?
My advice is always to read primary sources. The voices of people who actually live in that country. It could be, if you're interested in the Cultural Revolution, read a memoir or two on the Cultural Revolution. If you're interested in the 1920s, there's plenty of material. So what I'm trying to say is you read a primary source, you get much closer to the pulse of life, to the sense of it, but also to what actually happened. So here's one recommendation if you're interested in China recently. There's obviously my book, China After Mao. This is the prequel China Aftermath is a sequel of my trilogy, goes very nicely together with a book called Red Roulette by Desmond Shum, S-H-U-M. He's an insider. I call it a primary source. It's a fascinating book. So read primary sources. Translate it, doesn't really matter. You know, you don't need a degree in Chinese. There's plenty of books written by you know, people who lived through any one period. It's so much more fascinating.
And isn't there quite a group of locally based historians trying desperately to keep up an account, you know, under the guise, under the gaze of the authorities, and they just ride a very fine line. I wish I could remember. I did a very interesting interview on them. Brave, brave people.
Absolutely.
Really admirable. Absolutely. Sort of Chinese attitudes.
Absolutely.
To themselves.
Absolutely. I always tell my students the best historians of the Communist Party of China are inside China.
Yep.
They're not abroad. They're in Shanghai, they're in Beijing. They are brave, they're courageous, they spend a lifetime studying this stuff, and they frequently publish it. And it's pretty, pretty direct.
Yeah.
It's a lot more critical compared to what you might find within Sinological circles in Europe, Japan, or the United States.
Do you think it is their century, the China century? If you know, people...
No, that one was there very briefly, but it's over now.
Okay. All right.
Well, the book is called Red Dawn Over China. Please put your hands together for Frank Dakota.
Look, it was really interesting, I think, speaking to the audience after this recording, Geraldine. I had quite a few people come up to me, including one Australian of Chinese descent who said, look, I really appreciated you pushing him a little bit on some of that stuff. This is hotly contested, this view of China, right?
That's the point. But look, it was incredibly revealing to us, I thought, and I hope it was to all of you listening, just to sort of see the backdrop of this place that we now struggle to fully understand. So I hope we all take that into the future and, you know, when we stop thinking about Iran and places of the Middle East, that big giant still sits there.
Mm. Well, the world is asking a lot of us at the moment and trying to keep all of this in our mind at once and even to sort of think about the intersection of these things, right?
Indeed.
Like China and its connection with what's going on in the Gulf.
Indeed.
You know, just reading about the reliance of the Chinese economy on the oil that flows through the Strait of Hormuz, and you suddenly think, okay, you thought one thing about what Xi Jinping's view of Iran might be, but actually, do you need to flip that on its head?
Nothing is settled. That's the story. That is the story of wars, which is why they're so exhausting, even those of us who are blessed not to be in them. Look, we're on air every day at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. during the week, that is, on ABC Radio National. And, of course, anytime on ABC Listen, wherever you get your podcasts.
global.roaming@abc.net.au. Please keep the questions, the comments, the suggestions for episodes coming. We love to read it. Thanks to our producers, Kylie Morris, Jesse Kay and Simon Branthwaite. And please do join Kylie and myself for tomorrow's episode. We're talking to a fascinating Ukrainian politician who's visiting here in Australia. It makes for an interesting companion piece to the episode from Friday with the Estonian Foreign Minister.
Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.